Okay, we're going to look at the authority of Jesus being questioned here. But first, where we left off last time, if you'll recall, was Jesus was about to cleanse the temple, as it's called. And that'll be in chapter 11, verses 15 through 18. Actually, through 19. Let's look at those verses. In 11:15, it says, "Then they came to Jerusalem, and he entered the temple and began to drive out those who were buying and selling in the temple, and overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who were selling doves. And he would not permit anyone to carry merchandise through the temple. And he began to teach and say to them, 'Is it not written, My house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations, but you have made it a robber's den?' The chief priests and the scribes heard this and began seeking how to destroy him, for they were afraid of him, for the whole crowd was astonished at his teaching. And when evening came, they would go out of the city." So we're at the last week now. Jesus is in Jerusalem. And from this point on, Jesus' ministry will be centered in Jerusalem. As 11:1 says, they approached Jerusalem. And verse 11 says, Jesus entered Jerusalem. And verse 15, they came to Jerusalem. And verse 27, they came again to Jerusalem. So now we're going to be concentrating on his ministry in Jerusalem. His ministry was concentrated in Jerusalem, but at night he left the city, as we found out just in verse 9. It says that, or 19, I'm sorry, when evening came, they would go out of the city. Now, why do you suppose he left the city in the evening? You know, staying in the city overnight, if he had done that, it would have given the Sanhedrin, who were definitely out to get him, we know that by now, the Sanhedrin was out to kill him, as a matter of fact, and they would have an opportunity to arrest him without the multitudes being present. So they could have drug him away and no one would have known about it. And he didn't want that to happen. Now, wait a minute, you say, wait a minute. Wasn't he Jesus? I mean, could they have actually drug him away and killed him in private? He was God. Would God let that happen? He had a job to do. And here's a place where people often get confused, and it's a principle. You know, it's true. It's absolutely true that he could not be touched before his time. However, he was never foolhardy, and he never was presumptuous about his Father's care of him. And I think we can take an example from that. I know I'm accused a lot of times of not trusting God because I do certain things that I do, which I won't get into here. But, you know, have you ever been told that? And my response is always, well, do you trust God? And if they say yes, I say, okay, go stand in the middle of I-35 for an hour and, you know, we'll see if he protects you or not. That's being presumptuous. And Jesus, even Jesus, the God-man, was not presumptuous about his Father's protection. He did everything he could, but of course, God's sovereign will was in control. But he did everything in his power. Now we have the actions in Mark 11:15 and 16 where it says they came to Jerusalem and he entered the temple and began to drive out those who were buying and selling. Now picture this. It's going to be pandemonium. He was driving them out and selling in the temple and overturned the tables of the money changers, the seats of those who were selling doves, and he would not permit anyone to carry merchandise through the temple. So we have a picture of pandemonium. He's throwing tables over. He's dumping chairs over. He's not letting people bring their wares into the temple. And 15 and 16 are filled with confusion, clamor. But when we get to verse 17, We have total silence because Jesus starts to teach. So 15 and 16 kind of build up to verse 17. And these verses terminate with utter silence. In verse 17, Jesus begins to use the temple for the purpose for which it was built, intended. What was the temple for? Was it a mall, a shopping mall? No, it wasn't a shopping mall. It was a place where people would learn about God. They'd learn about Him through the Old Testament ritual ceremonies. They would learn about Him in the porticos, remember, where the teachers stood. We studied that in some of the other Gospels. So He starts to use the temple for the purpose in which it was intended. He teaches, and His teaching is biblical. Notice what He says. Is it not written? And that's His argument. Is it not written, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations? True, that's written. It's biblical. But it's also direct. He said, but you made it a robber's den. So He's biblical, and yet He's very direct. He doesn't beat around the bush. He tells them like it is. Okay, you guys, you know, this is what the temple is for. It's for teaching. It's for a house of prayer for all the nations. Remember the court of the Gentiles? The Gentiles could come into the temple as well. They couldn't go into the holy place, but they could come into the court of the Gentiles in the outer court of the temple. And He calls the temple a robber's den. He said, you've made this a robber's den. What do you suppose He means by that? Does He mean they were actually cheating people there in the temple and robbing them? Well, actually, the term robber's den is not exactly a place where robbery occurs. That's the scene of the crime, as we would say. A robber's den is a place where robbers take refuge, where they go to hide out. Now, see if you can relate this to anything in our culture. You know, His meaning comes from Jeremiah chapter 7. Flip back to Jeremiah for a second. In chapter 7 and verse 8, it says, behold, you are trusting in deceptive words to no avail. Will you steal, murder, commit adultery, and swear falsely? And offer sacrifices to Baal and walk after other gods that you have not known? And then come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, and say, we are delivered, that you may do all these abominations? Has this house, which is called by my name, become a den of robbers in your sight? Behold, I, even I, have seen it, declares the Lord. And that's where He gets that robber's den reference. And what were they doing back there? They were going out and committing any kind of sin they wanted to. Just sin all week long. But as long as you go back to the temple, everything's okay. You know, you go back to the temple and you say, we're delivered. You go to confession. I mean, he goes back to the temple and everything's okay again. It's just a mental attitude that these guys had, that they could sin as much as they pleased and then go to the hideout, which is what the robber's den was. We would call it a hideout, and say, we're delivered. And God says your actions don't match your doctrine. And that's not a way to have fellowship with God. They felt secure in their lifestyle as long as the temple was part of it. As long as they did this ritual, then it was okay to go out and do anything else that they wanted to. So what does the Sanhedrin have to say about all this? Well, in verse 18, it says, the chief priests and the scribes heard this and began seeking how to destroy him, for they were afraid of him. for the whole crowd was astonished at his teaching. Now, Jesus was teaching. It says they were astonished at his teaching, and that's what the temple was for teaching. And he started to teach, and the crowd was astonished, and the Sanhedrin got scared. You know, the Sanhedrin was the ruling body of the Jewish people at that time, under, of course, the Roman governor. They didn't want that, but that's the way it was. They were under the Roman government, but they were the ruling body of the Jews. And even they couldn't kill someone without Rome's consent. So what does doctrine do to these guys? Well, it has enormous power to do two things. Doctrine, when you teach doctrine, it has enormous power. And it does two things. First, it gets the religious people indignant. They get mad because you're teaching truth. Secondly, it gets people thinking. The crowd was amazed. The religious people were furious. And that's what happens when you teach doctrine. It gets people thinking. It gets religious people upset. So they're still determined to kill Jesus here, as we see. But it's not mentioned how yet. This is still in the planning stage. It's still in the we're going to kill him stage. Of course, he knew how. He had mentioned that earlier, but they hadn't disclosed their method yet. Now that brings us to verse 20 through 25, and it's a sequel to the fig tree incident back in verses 20 through 22. Remember the fig tree? And we saw the fig tree incident started, and then the cleansing of the temple, and then we have another reference to the fig tree. So the cleansing of the temple is somehow related to the fig tree episode. And back in verse 11:20, where it says, as they were passing by in the morning, they saw the fig tree withered from the roots up. We'll look back at verses 13 and 14 when it said, seeing at a distance a fig tree in leaf, he went to see if perhaps he would find anything on it. And when he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. He said to it, may no one ever eat fruit from you again. And his disciples were listening. Now it goes right from there into the cleansing of the temple. And then we get down to verse 20, and it says, as they were passing by in the morning, they saw the fig tree withered from the roots up. So how does the fig tree relate to the cleansing of the temple? Well, probably the best interpretation and the earliest one, and we noted that last week, is that the fig tree concealed its fruit because it was in leaf. It had leaves. You couldn't see if it had fruit or not. So it concealed the fact that it was not bearing fruit at the time, which was normal because it wasn't the season for fig trees to be bearing figs. And the very most ancient, the oldest commentary on the book of Mark that we have, it's explained this way, and I think it's a good explanation. It says, you know, the fig tree concealed the fact that it wasn't bearing figs because it had leaves all over it. And the temple was concealing the fact that Israel had not brought forth fruit because they had this beautiful temple. They had all these religious rituals that they performed in it. And they felt, as the cleansing of the temple shows, that as long as they came to the temple, then they could go out and sin all they want. They didn't have to bear fruit. All they had to do was come back to the temple. So there's a parallel between the incident of the fig tree and the incident of the temple. You know, Israel did not possess the righteousness that God demands, nor do any of us. Jesus is teaching them a lesson here. Now, a remarkable thing happened to this fig tree. It withered from the roots up within 24 hours of Jesus cursing it. And keep in mind, it was a wild fig tree. Jesus didn't destroy someone else's property. It was by the side of the road, Matthew tells us. And Peter is struck with the fact, you know, there's got to be more to this than just a withered fig tree. And you can see that in verse 21 where Peter says, Rabbi, look, the fig tree which you cursed is withered. Now there's an implied question that goes with that statement, and that's, what does that mean? The fig tree that you talked about yesterday, it's withered from the roots up. What does that mean? How can that be? Well, the following verses are going to explain that. They're an expansion of that thought. And the principle is given in verse 23. And it's important, again, as always, that we understand these verses in context, because they're often taken out of context. Verse 23 especially. And it's one of the favorite verses of those who promote the prosperity gospel. And I will not teach against the prosperity gospel. I will just preach truth. And that should dispel any notions that the prosperity gospel has any relevance to anyone. So the principle is simply this. The summary statement of this little discourse is, have faith in God. That's in verse 23. He says, truly I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, be taken up and cast into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that what he says is going to happen, it will be granted him. Therefore I say to you, all things for which you pray and ask, believe that you have received them, and they will be granted to you. But verse 22 gives us the summary. It's not in 23, it's in 22. It says, Jesus answered, saying to them, have faith in God. Now he goes on to give a little illustration of that. And he's speaking hyperbolically. He's using a figure of speech called hyperbole. It's a present active imperative verb. That means that what he's saying is keep on having faith in God all the time. Your faith should be in God. Now, how does a dead fig tree teach that truth? Well, if you notice in the context, Jesus doesn't really address the fig tree. He kind of switches here, doesn't he? He says, Peter asks him about the fig tree, and he says, have faith in God. Well, wait a minute, what's that got to do with it? Well, he's going to address a subject that's immediately important to the disciples, the importance of faith. And faith in the correct object. He doesn't just say have faith. He says have faith in God. And that's what the disciples needed to learn. Then he goes on with the illustration. And it's a visible illustration. Keep in mind, from the Mount of Olives, you can see the Dead Sea. So he's giving them an illustration that they're looking at. They can see this. He said, if you said to this mountain, go into the sea, then it'll do it if you have enough faith, if you keep believing in God. Now, one explanation of that, and it's possible, I'll give this a possible category, is in Zechariah 14:4. Flip back to Zechariah. Zechariah 14:4 says, in that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives. And it's talking about the second advent here. It says, in that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which is in front of Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives will be split in its middle from east to west by a very large valley, so that half of the mountain will move toward the north and the other half toward the south. And it goes on to say that down in verse 10, in fact, it says, and all the land will be changed into a plain. So if the reference is to this section in Zechariah, this prophecy of Zechariah, then what he's talking about would limit that prayer to the prayer for Jesus to establish his reign, for his second coming. It would be a prayer to the second coming. Now that's a possible explanation. Either way, the point of it is, going back to Mark, what's the point that he's trying to make? You know, even if you can't limit that reference, which I'm not entirely convinced you can limit it to Zechariah, but even if you can't, Jesus is talking in a hyperbole here. He's emphasizing the greatness of God's power. Do you really think that God is giving the disciples here a blank check and saying, anything you want for, you can have. Just got to believe hard enough. You think that's what he's teaching these guys? And that's what the prosperity gospel people will tell you. You know, if you have enough faith and you believe something, it'll happen. So you get disappointed. What do they say? Well, you didn't have enough faith. Sorry. Remember when we looked at the incident of the disciples trying to heal the demon-possessed boy and they couldn't do it? What did Jesus say? The boy didn't have enough faith? No, he said, you guys don't have enough faith. It was the healers that didn't have enough faith, not the healed. So if you try to apply these verses to healing, it doesn't match, because he said before, if a person isn't healed, it's not because they didn't have enough faith, it's because the healer didn't have enough faith. And of course, this is pre-church age. It's nothing to do whatsoever with the church. You know, as Chester used to call it, like opening day ceremonies, when he was going to begin the church, he was going to die on the cross, he came, his first advent, and all these miracles happened. The healings, the tongues, all of this stuff. And then they faded off. And I don't believe we have those anymore, but that's another topic that we've covered in the past. And I think the same thing is true here, that Jesus isn't giving the disciples a blank check. He's not just saying, whatever you pray for, just believe real hard and you'll get it. What he's teaching is the disciples have an extraordinary mission in front of them. They're going to be the apostles. They've got a really tough job ahead. Most of them are going to die for their faith. Remember Peter in the book of Acts and Paul in the book of Acts. Of course, Paul wasn't here yet. He wasn't a believer yet. But the disciples, the apostles, they had hard lives. And he's getting them ready for that. He's saying, look, you have to have faith in God. That's the only thing that will protect you and keep you going. Do you really think the disciples needed power to throw mountains around? Is that what Jesus is saying in these verses? Not really. J. Vernon McGee puts it this way. They needed faith to meet the mountains of opposition they're going to encounter. That's paraphrased a little bit, but that's pretty much what he said. The point is that God accomplishes everything. Depend on him, not yourself, because he accomplishes things. You don't. No matter how much faith you have, really, you don't accomplish anything. God accomplishes. I was showing these kids up here just before class today that I have a book that when I think I've accomplished something pretty neat, you know, we all do that. We think, ah, boy, I am so spiritual. I accomplished this great spiritual deed. I take this book out and look through it because it's a concordance of the Hebrew Old Testament. It was written by a guy named Lasowski, and it's handwritten, over 1,000 pages of handwritten Hebrew calligraphy, and every Hebrew word is translated into German, English, and Latin, and it's listed every place it's used in the Old Testament. If I think I've done something cool, I go look at Lasowski and say, I haven't done anything. Even comparatively speaking, I haven't done anything. God accomplishes everything, not us. We need to depend on Him, not on us. Now we're going to have the authority of Jesus is going to be questioned in verse 27 through 33. Verse 27 reads, "They came again to Jerusalem, and as He was walking in the temple, the chief priests and the scribes and the elders came to Him and began saying to Him, 'By what authority are you doing these things? Or who gave you this authority to do these things?' And Jesus said to them, 'I will ask you one question, and you answer me, then I will tell you by what authority I do these things. Was the baptism of John from heaven or from men? Answer me.'" It's a brilliant question, of course. "And they began reasoning among themselves, saying, 'If we say from heaven, He will say, then why did you not believe Him? But shall we say from men?' They were afraid of the people, for everyone considered John to have been a real prophet. Answering Jesus, they said, 'We do not know.' And Jesus said to them, 'Nor will I tell you by what authority I do these things.'" It's a brilliant answer to their question. Remember, their strategy is still the same as it always was. Their strategy was to trap Him. Now, this little section in verse 11:27 through 12:27 actually is important because it establishes that all of the important groups in Jewish life or within Jerusalem, all of the groups important in the Jewish life were hostile towards Jesus, all of them. The chief priests, scribes, and elders. In 11:27, it says, "They came again to Jerusalem, and as He was walking in the temple, the chief priests and the scribes and the elders came to Him." So those three were questioning His authority. Where do you get the authority to do these things? Now, in 12:1 through 11, we'll have a parable, and it's a parable of the defiant tenants who killed the owner's son. And it ends up in verse 12, "And they were seeking to seize Him, and yet they feared the people, for they understood that He spoke the parable against them." So He's talking about the religious leaders again. So that parable points to the religious leaders of the country. And the Pharisees and the Herodians in verse 13, where it says, "Then they sent some of the Pharisees and Herodians to Him in order to trap Him in a statement." And again, that's a very remarkable thing, because the Pharisees and the Herodians did not get along very well. But they had a common enemy, and they wanted to take care of Him. Again, their plan is still to trap Him. The Sadducees, 12:18, "Some Sadducees who say there is no resurrection came to Jesus and began questioning Him." So the Sadducees were against Him. All these groups now, we got the chief priests, scribes, elders, and the defiant tenants who represent the leaders of the Jewish religion, the Pharisees, the Herodians, and the Sadducees. They're all hostile towards Jesus. And the plan is the same as it always was. They were going to trap Jesus into saying something that they could have Him put to death for. First, they question His authority. We just looked at in verse 11:28. They have a question about taxes that is intended to trap Him in 12:13 and 14. They sent some Pharisees and Herodians in order to trap Him. And they came and said to Him, "Teacher, we know that You are truthful and defer to no one, For you are not partial to any, but teach the way of God in truth. Is it lawful to pay a poll tax to Caesar or not? And they're trying to trap him with that question. They didn't want information. They wanted to trap him into saying something that they could go to the Romans and say, this guy said we shouldn't pay taxes. You know, and the Roman government then would respond. So that was designed to trap him. It wasn't designed to get information. A question about remarriage in verses 18 and 19, where it says, teacher, in verse 19, Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies and leaves behind a wife and leaves no child, his brother should marry the wife and raise up children to his brother. And then they go through this seven brothers, seven brides, or one bride for seven brothers, I guess, in this parable. And he teaches them on that subject. Of course, they didn't believe in resurrection. So they said, well, if you believe in resurrection, then this wife was married to more than one man. Who's her husband when they get resurrected? See how that's designed to trick him. They didn't want information. So the last week in Jerusalem will have filled with Jesus' teaching, and it's mostly in response to questions that were designed to trap him. The issue is going to be his opponent's relationship to him and his word. That's going to be the issue. Taxes aren't the issue, and they're just trying to trap him with those questions. So the question about Jesus' authority in verse 27 through 33, we have the question in 27 and 28, and verse 27 says, back in chapter 11, they came again to Jerusalem, and he's walking in the temple. The chief priests and the scribes and the elders came to him and began saying to him, by what authority are you doing these things? Or who gave you this authority to do these things? Now we're going to have the temple being the focal point. We've come to Jerusalem now, and Jerusalem is going to be the focal point of his ministry, but not just Jerusalem. We're drilling down to the temple now. So Jesus makes the temple the focal point of his ministry. And of course, the temple was the heart of Jewish life. And of course, they thought the temple was their scapegoat. You know, we can do anything as long as we come back to the temple. It's also going to be the setting for the Olivet Discourse, which will come up in chapter 13, which is a very abbreviated form of the Olivet Discourse that we have in Matthew 24 and 25 that covers two chapters over there. And the question they ask him, where do you get the authority for doing these things? Now, what are the these things they're talking about? Well, two things pop to mind. First, the cleansing of the temple. He took the merchants and gave them the bum's rush out of the temple, basically. And his teaching and the response to it. Look at verse 18 of chapter 11 that we read, and it says in the last part of the verse, they were afraid of him, for the whole crowd was astonished at his teaching. And they're saying, where do you get the authority to teach these things? Where do you get the authority to drive the merchants out of the temple? Where does it come from? So he doesn't respond directly. They're not after information. They're after to trap him. So he responds with another question in verse 29 and 30 when he says, and Jesus said to them, I will ask you one question, and you answer me, then I will tell you by what authority I do these things. Was the baptism of John from heaven or from men? So the counter question, was the baptism of John from heaven or from men? They're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place here. Because if they say from heaven, two things are going to happen immediately. First, they're going to be forced to admit their unbelief because they didn't believe John. And if they say, yes, his baptism was from heaven, then they have to admit they didn't believe it. They didn't believe in him. Second, they'd be forced to accept Jesus' authority because John is the one who baptized him. So they don't want to say that. They don't want to admit that John the Baptist was actually a prophet, or that puts them in a very difficult position. On the other hand, if they say not from heaven, they would have to contend with the multitudes. And the multitudes thought John was a prophet. They all agreed. And the religious leaders were afraid of the people. So they're really stuck here, aren't they? What are they going to say? Well, they say the only thing they can in verse 33, I don't know, basically. So the result in 31 to 33, it's explained if they say from heaven, they condemn themselves. But if they say no, they endanger themselves. So they're stuck either way. And the bottom line is simply this. These men had no interest in the answer to that question except to trick Jesus into saying something that could be used against him. That's all they wanted to do. They had no desire for information, for truth. So Jesus doesn't give them any. He says, well then, if you don't want to hear the truth, I'm not going to tell it to you. And he leaves them in their ignorance. Now next time we'll have the parables, the parable of the vine growers in chapter 12. And we'll pick up in 12:1. Father, thank you for your word, which is living and powerful, and we thank you for the gospels that you've given us to give us historical facts about the life of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, in whose name we pray. Amen.